morning. The committee will come to order today, the Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection for Wednesday, February 2nd, 2011. And appreciate everybody being here for another one of our overviews. And we also are going to be doing our first bill today as well. Today's overview is related to yesterday's. We tried to group these at least to be close together. We talked a lot about real estate, and we reviewed the foreclosure bills that we've passed last year. And today we're going to be hearing on some of the financial industries that we have jurisdiction over, and namely banking and also credit union. Overview. So let's go ahead and get started. And why don't we have you both introduce yourselves for the record, and then we'll be talking about some banking for a little while. So good morning, and thank you for coming.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Tess Rice. I'm General Counsel and the Director of Government Relations for Minnesota Bankers Association.
And I'm Teresa Cuvas, Senior Government Relations Specialist with Minnesota Bankers Association. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to come in and speak to you about our association and about the banking industry in general.
Ms. Cuvas, I should say also that what we've been doing as a format, if anybody should have questions, any committee members have questions, feel free to grab our attention or grab my attention and jump in, and we'll do it as we go.
Just turning it off.
You can tell a lot about people from their ringtones.
What does that tell us?
I think we can name that tune. all right, Ms. Cuvas, go ahead with the bank.
That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. Just wanted to start with the Minnesota layout of banks in general. There are 404 banks and thrifts, Minnesota chartered. Those can both be state chartered or nationally chartered in the state. As we heard a couple of weeks ago from Commissioner Rothman and Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy, 304 of the 404 banks in Minnesota are state chartered. So the additional ones would be nationally chartered banks or thrifts. There are 50,000 employees that banks do employ within the state, so we do have a good chunk of the workforce in the state. A lot of them are some of our larger members, but our smaller members, you know, the heart of the community, do take up quite a bit of bank employees also. The map kind of shows our membership in general, so we kind of do have a wide variety of the state covered with members.
Ms. Crossway, why would a bank choose that it's their option? They can either pursue the federal chartered status or the state chartered status. What are the considerations that a bank might go through to decide, and why, you know, we have two different paths?
Mr. Chair, Senators, there are different advantages or disadvantages to all the charters. When you're a national bank, you have one examiner. So you have the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency coming into your bank. If you have a state charter, you're going to have the Department of Commerce, and you will also have either the FDIC or the Federal Reserve Bank coming in. Sometimes there's feeling that one regulator is more difficult to deal with than the other, or one is nicer than the other. I mean, it's just because we have so many of all of them, I think each charter offers something that fits a bank's business plan and just fits what they want. So that's why we have a variety.
And another reason might be that they might have branches in other states, which we have 404 that are Minnesota charter-based, headquartered here, but there are 38 other banks that do have the do business in the state also, which would be Wells Fargo and quite a few of the other ones. Minnesota does have the third largest number of banks in the country. We are just behind Texas and Illinois, so we have 404 banks that are headquartered here, which is 5.3% of the country of banks here. So we do have a wide variety. Those are banks, you know, they're community banks, mid-sized banks, and the larger banks. So we do have great options for Minnesotans when it comes to banks in general. For the MBA membership for our association, we have 93% of the banks as members. This would be the small community banks, mid-sized community banks in general, and then we also have we have TCF, U.S. Bank, and Wells Fargo being our three largest members also. Asset size of banks in Minnesota, our smallest member is Kent State Bank, which was established in 1902 with $7 million in total assets, and they have three employees in their bank. The largest Minnesota charter-based bank is Bremer Bank, $4.8 billion in assets, 51 offices, and 1,800 employees. And then our largest national bank is Wells Fargo. They have 20,000 employees in the state and 179 locations. So we do have a great variety of banks in the state. The average size of the median Minnesota bank is Pioneer National Bank in Duluth. 25 employees, $83 million in assets in three locations. The average size of a bank in Minnesota is under $100 million in assets. This graph shows how banks have decreased over the years. As Commissioner Rothman and Kevin Murphy mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we were well over 800 25, 30 years ago, and just progressively it has declined. A big point out of it is that the branching laws changed back years ago so that Wells Fargo and a lot of the others were able to, some of the larger members were able to branch into other other communities. So.
We had just one bank failure back in 2008. So that was really the beginning of this. Before 2008, we hadn't had a bank failure for some time. That was a small failure relative to others. It was a cost of $2.3 million to the fund. In 2009, we had six more bank failures. That cost $242 million. And those banks were purchased by some Minnesota banks, North Dakota and South Dakota banks. In 2010, we had eight more bank failures, and the cost to the fund was $52 million. And they were also purchased by Midwest banks. Minnesota bank failures represent less than 5% of those in the country, and that is about right, since we have just over 5% of the banks of the country.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Yes, Senator Brown.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have a question. When a bank fails, I know they're insured by the FDIC now for up to $500,000. If someone, for instance, were to have $1 million in that bank when it fails, are they only covered the $500,000? Is there a total million covered when another bank buys it? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it's $250 million is the cap for FDIC insurance, but it goes by account type, so a customer could have many different accounts that have separate coverage in them. It changes by their ownership, so okay. If you had a joint account, it would be insured separately from an individual account. I haven't heard of any depositors losing their money, so the bank deposits would stay at that bank. It's normally acquired by a new bank and with very little interruption in availability for the customer.
So if one account had a deposit of over $250,000, it's not like they lost the difference.
Well, I think they probably could lose that if they didn't stay under that limit.
Okay.
Yes.
Questions? Please continue.
I hope this wasn't covered in depth yesterday. I'm sorry if it was, but so the bank would normally reopen the next business day or so. It's a very orderly procedure. The bank that is acquiring the new bank might purchase some or all of the assets. If they don't purchase all of the assets, which would be the loans, then the FDIC sells those to investors. The FDIC insurance program is self-funded by banks, so they are paying premiums normally yearly to cover any potential bank failures. And they have covered that fund has covered all those bank failures. So it's all paid for by banks.
So could you tell me those assessments for the FDIC? I think those have been increasing.
Right.
Has that been, can you tell us about how much have they been decreasing? Is that becoming concerning or a burden? Or where is that at with those FDIC fees?
Mr. Chair, I have an example of a median-sized bank, like the one we showed, with 20 employees or so. In 2008, their premium was $30,000.
Okay.
Anticipating. And then in 2009, that went up to $130,000 for that bank. And then in 2010, they were asked to prepay through 2012. So that was $363,000 for that bank that they're handing over in cash. It's a significant amount of money. The banking industry is among the most highly regulated industries in the United States, and they have extensive on-site examinations, and they also file call reports with a lot of detailed information about their business, deposits, loans, and that kind of thing. We mentioned that there are different regulators, the OCC for national banks, and then the OTS currently is the regulator for federal savings banks or thrifts. They are merging into the OCC in July, so there will be one regulator for national banks and for thrifts. The FDIC has the state non-member banks, and the Federal Reserve is what they consider state member banks because they're part of the Federal Reserve system. And then the Department of Commerce would have all of those FDIC and Federal Reserve banks. So pie chart. The purple color is the FDIC, so you can see what chunk they have. It's a large chunk, 279 banks, 69%. So if you add the Federal Reserve, the green, to that, you see that that would be the Department of Commerce's purview, which is a large chunk of the state. Normally, a bank would have an on-site examination every 12 months, but some of the smaller banks where the assets are less than $250 million, if they're in good shape, then it's going to be once every 18 months. There are separate exams normally for safety and soundness, so you get a team of experts in that field would come into a bank, maybe for a few days, maybe for a few weeks, and sit at the conference table and look through their loans, a sampling of their loans and other things. Another team will come in, a consumer compliance team, and make sure that the bank is complying with all the consumer regulations. There's also information technology teams, and then bank holding company reviews too. The Federal Reserve is in charge of bank holding company exams for all banks, including national banks. The call reports that banks file have a lot of detail, as I mentioned, and data that goes into those reports is used to prepare the Uniform Bank Performance Report. And that report's really important because it compares banks to their peers, so you can see where a bank might have some, you know, if they are too different from their peers, there could be things in there that would catch a regulator's attention. They review those very carefully. I took some pictures in my office of our regulations. Those four books to the left are just the federal regulations that banks need to follow. And then on the right, those are all the manuals that we produce to help our members comply with those regulations. So it's a significant amount. The ABA estimates it's more than 11,000 pages of regulation that are meant to protect depositors and to keep banks safe and sound. The Dodd-Frank Act, which passed in July of last year, is 2,300 pages of new law for banks to deal with. There are some good things in there regarding too big to fail and regulating the shadow banking industry, but a lot of that burden was passed on to all the banks, the traditional banks, that weren't necessarily the cause of the economic crisis.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the Dodd-Frank Act, yesterday was Bankers Day at the Capitol, and so I had the opportunity to meet with several bankers, which was really nice that so many did come to the Capitol. And they mentioned a provision in that act that actually is having a pretty detrimental effect on them. I wondered if you were planning to address that today in your remarks, the change in the fee structure with regard to the debit card, you know, credit cards.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I wasn't going to, but I would be happy to.
Please do. Thank you.
The Durbin Amendment to the Dodd-Frank Act limited the amount of interchange fees that a bank could earn on debit cards. That fee varied normally based on a percentage of a transaction amount, and it is now limited to proposed regulations would limit it to 12 cents per transaction, between 7 cents and 12 cents per transaction, which would reduce their income from those cards by 77%, I believe is the estimate. So they will not be able to take into account fraud loss when they set their fees for these cards, or the cost to maintain the system, and also the cost to put together that system is not taken into consideration. So it is a very difficult thing for them, and you know that's why we're seeing some banks having to increase fees on checking accounts, because those fees kind of subsidized a lot of the free services that banks were offering.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question. Do you expect that there will be an effort in this congressional session to repeal that? Is there anything you think we could be doing as a state legislature to address some of that concern?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, I know there are efforts at the federal level, and I know that we have been talking to our congresspeople about that. I think some legislation's been proposed by Representative Bachman.
Congresswoman Bachman has attempted to repeal the entire bill. So,
surprise.
Oh, that would include it.
We're not overly hopeful, but there may be some direction from Congress back to the Federal Reserve about the this restrictiveness of these rules.
Okay. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Vandeveer.
Why would you want to repeal something that worked so good?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it isn't effective yet, so.
Yeah. Senator Cruz, did you have a question? No? Okay. Senator Vandeveer, are you done?
I'm done for now, Mr. Chair.
No witty follow-up?
Oh, well, if you'd like to discuss this for
now. Well, I will say that is an issue that we've had several meetings. People have come to me on the interchange issue on both sides, on the bank side and also the retailers, and we have had some discussions about that. No bill, to my knowledge, has been introduced, and I have not seen any language on anything yet. So there has been some concept about something dealing with that topic, but there is probably limited things we can do at the state level to affect what's happening with the Dodd-Frank Act on that. So, okay. Ms. Rice, if you want to continue.
Thank you. We're expecting 5,000 pages of new regulation from the Dodd-Frank Act. And those are in addition to all the regulations that have been passed recently. We have 30 new or revised regulations issued in the past 2 years at the federal level. So, it's been a very, very trying time. And a lot of our community banks are telling us that it's just becoming unmanageable. They need to devote at least 6% of their workforce and 10% of their operating expenses on compliance with these laws. So it keeps them from doing what they're best at. And we're not aware of any other small business that would have such an extensive regulatory environment. And experts are saying that this is forcing a lot of banks to try to find someone to acquire them or merge with another bank, because the compliance burden at a large bank can be, they can spread that out. They could hire one person to handle, a lot of business. But with a community bank, some of them need a full-time compliance person to deal with these issues, and that's a large portion of their staff. So we think that burden impacts their ability to offer as many products and services as they would like to do to help their customers. I mean, they really want to be in the business of making loans and protecting deposits, but a lot of their time is spent complying with regulation. That is all that we have, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Hey, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. You touched a little bit on the stress tests and the different groups that implement those stress tests. Is there a central location where the data is kept for the results of those tests?
Mr. Chair, Senator, was it yesterday that you heard that about stress testing?
Today. Well, I'm assuming that when you talked about, a little bit back here, right after you were talking about the different regulators and then the bank exams. Is that when you say bank exams, is that what you're talking about is stress tests, or is that something completely different?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when I think of stress testing, I think of the examiners recommend that banks test their own portfolios. So they use the data of the loans that they have and then change the environment. So change the interest rate environment or the economic environment and see what that does to their portfolio. Maybe the examiners do that as well. I don't know if they do, but I know banks do that with their portfolios.
Okay, and then Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cruz.
Just another quick question. We had the realtors in front of us yesterday, and there were a couple of great points brought up about walking the fine line between allowing banks to protect themselves as far as lending and making sure that folks who are applying for a mortgage are, you know, going to be capable of fulfilling that contract, and the flip side of that, which is making sure that we have enough fluidness in the market that folks who, you know, want to and are able to can get those loans. Can you speak to us a little bit about walking that fine line and what we can do to help in that process?
Mr. Chair, Senator,
nice.
I think that the regulatory environment has shifted so much since this crisis. And if you're talking about home mortgages, the secondary market has tightened their standards significantly. We have federal regulations that require us now to consider a person's reasonable ability to repay the loan. And so there's more regulatory involvement in your loan decision than there was before. We also have that at the state level. It doesn't apply to banks. It applies to brokers, but that reasonable ability to pay and then giving the factors that you are allowed to consider. I think before that, banks could set their own underwriting standards. So this has tightened it up significantly, and then the regulators are being very careful. I mean, our members are telling us that their exams are extremely detailed, and there is a lot of criticism some of them are experiencing, and perhaps rightly so, but it's just a different environment than they have been in when economic times were good.
Senator Cruz.
It just, you know, it kind of, the second part of that question, you know, do you see that, the environment we're in right now, as a positive environment? Is this something that you would like to see continue the way it is, or do you have any recommendations for us, if you think there can be changes, what those changes might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't think of any state law that gets in the way of banks doing business too much. I mean, it's not a bad state to be a bank in. You know, there isn't some obvious law I could point to and say you can make bankers' lives better if you did something about that. I mean, they're happy generally with the Department of Commerce and with the structure of our statutes. It's mostly that federal burden, that the regulatory burden that they are having trouble getting past, and I don't believe that they are happy with it. But I think a lot of the change has to do with brokers being out of the business. Once we required them to register, and, of course, the market not being that good, so many of them are out of the business right now. And so you have a lot of loans going back to the banks where they always had underwriting standards. You know, there weren't as much of what they called liar loans or things like that where they weren't verifying income. I mean, banks verify income. So I think that market has shifted towards banks somewhat, so I suppose that's good for us in some ways. But I think there are a lot of banks that have tried to get out of real estate lending because they're finding that these standards are too high. There are other laws, like a lot of community banks do balloon loans to their customers. They can't carry a 30-year mortgage. I mean, a small bank, they're normally sold on the secondary market, and they like to make loans they can keep at the bank. So that would be a 3-year, 5-, or 7-year balloon. But federal requirements over the past, I think, year and a half have significantly impeded being able to make those loans because of that ability to repay standard. Originally, it was that they had to be able to repay that balloon at the time that they applied for the loan. They had to have, like, the cash on hand or, you know, to pay that balloon. Well, of course, that's not how it would work. If someone had that much cash, they could just buy the property outright. So I think a lot of the federal laws have kind of pushed banks away, some of the smaller banks away from residential lending because of the risk. And then there's a lot in this home equity line market, which a lot of people don't have equity in their homes now. And so I think that business has slowed down significantly as well.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned brokers and liar loans and things like that. How many brokers do you know that underwrote their own loans?
Mr. Chair.
That's right.
Senator Vandeveer, that's probably a really good point. I mean, they're underwriting for the standards of the investors. So perhaps there's less investors, or the investors' standards are higher. I know that at least Fannie Mae standards are higher than they were, but there are other investors like Fannie Mae on the secondary market.
Well, Mr. Chair, it was my understanding that loans are underwritten by the broker, might be a correspondent or whatever, but that all their loans were underwritten by banks or the investor that was compiling the package for investment. Is that not true?
Ms. Grace?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vandeveer, I don't know. I mean, I suppose there were some big bank investors that would purchase mortgages outright, and they would have their standards, but I think that you're right that whoever the investor is, the one that sets the standards for the mortgage broker. Whether the mortgage broker knows that the information they're giving the investor is accurate or correct, I guess, is another issue.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me some idea, you were speaking of liar loans, what percent of the loans in the last few years would be in that category?
Mr.
Any
Chair.
Idea?
Senator, I wish I had not said those two words because I don't know very much about them. I'm sorry. I don't think that our banking industry was very involved in that, and so I'm sorry. I don't know.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Then I have one that I did say I was going to bring up, and that was when we were talking to the realtors yesterday, and it was about short sales, and I was the one who brought it up because I hear from a lot of individual realtors that they have difficulty with, there's a lot more short sales, but they have a lot of difficulty with banks getting approval or communicating, getting answers back, and it seems to take forever. And I don't know if you have an answer for that or not. Actually, the answer given yesterday wasn't their place to say, but they did make a good point that, you know, you're being asked or your industry is asked to be taking a hit on a particular transaction, and you can't expect them to turn on a dime and jump for joy at that. But I hear a lot that with individual agents that their transactions are slowed and sometimes don't happen because of the slow approval process. Is there any discussion within your association about handling of short sales? And are you hearing anything about that being slow, or is anything being done to speed that process up at all? Can you offer any advice?
Mr. Chair, Senators, I've heard about it since yesterday, and we've been looking into it since yesterday.
Oh, okay.
What we've discovered, of course, is that there's no formula for this. Every bank would be different, would have its own standards. They've got to look at each transaction individually because, of course, the offer on the house is an individual offer. I think some of the larger players may be implementing some computer systems to be able to do that analysis, and that might speed things up. An issue that we heard was that second mortgages often are an impediment because that person with the second lien or the bank with the second lien has to approve the short sale as well, and there's normally no money for them in that transaction. So I think there's a lot of different reasons why they might take some time.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Appreciate it. And what we're going to do is we're going to have David Skillbred come up and talk about a related association, the Independent Community Bankers. While he's coming up, I'm going to ask, without objection, that maybe we could make a slight change to the agenda. I know we have a quorum here. We've got a lot of members here. I know there's another meeting coming up at 11:30 for some folks. And so what I thought is maybe we could switch the order of items number 2 and 3 on the agenda and take up Senator Carlson's bill, Senate File 125, after Mr. Skillbred's presentation. We'll take care of that, handle that, and then we'll go into the presentation from the credit union overview and handle that last on our agenda. So without objection, I think that's what we'll do. Mr. Skillbred, maybe you could identify yourself and your organization for the record and talk to us about how your organization works with and is different than the Minnesota Bankers Association.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is David Skillbred. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Thank you for the time to share with you a little bit about our association.
Welcome.
The previous testimony was a very good, broad preview and discussion about the industry in Minnesota. What I'd like to do is focus down a little bit more so just on the community banks, their characteristics, and talk about them as opposed to the industry. First of all, our association is a statewide association made up entirely of community banks. So big banks are not members of our association. We have small community banks in all areas of the state, inner city neighborhoods, suburban areas, and in greater Minnesota. The previous testimony talked a little bit about our charter system that we follow. So we have national chartered community banks, about 100 of those in Minnesota, and state chartered community banks, about 300 of those. So both of those national and state community banks would be members of our association. The characteristics of a community bank, we've had a lot of discussions about financial institutions in this committee over the years, and that's a very broad umbrella term that applies to a number of different entities, including banks, insurance companies, credit unions, and several other entities. And likewise, banks are not all the same either. So there's big and small, and community banks have these characteristics. And if you think about a small bank that you've worked with, I think that you'll know this information kind of intuitively. Number one, they provide face-to-face service. You know your lender, and those lenders are there at the bank for many, many years, if not generations. It's not a 1-800 number that you call or an office where the staff may change significantly over time. Secondly, you know your lender, and the lender knows you. Oftentimes, these community bankers are second, third, fourth generation bankers. So they not only have been in the community a long time themselves, but their parents and their grandparents. And likewise, there's a very long relationship standing between the families in this community and the businesses and that sort of thing. We use local deposits for local loans. A little the discussion over here regarding mortgages and how those are financed, that kind of brings to bear the issue of how things are financed, and community bankers, for the most part, use local deposits for local loans. Likewise, on the decisions for those loans, if you are a customer and you have a loan application, that banker is the one that you've got accounts with, you can make that application with, and that's where the decision is going to be made. It isn't going to be mailed to another office and made by somebody else that doesn't know you personally. A local commitment. These communities and community banks are together over a long period of time. In Minnesota, of those about 400 charters, there are nearly 200 charters that are over 100 years old. That, to me, is, talks about the commitment that that bank has in the area. They're not going to get up and go when the time gets tough and go somewhere else to make more money. They're committed to their community. Character counts. A lot of issues on the table come when the loan application comes in. And when you know your customer and then you have all the financial data that you need to have to make a good decision, when you go to a community banker, they're going to look at you, and they're going to know and count the character before them. And finally, they are small business lenders. They are small businesses themselves, and one of their niche areas is to really make small business loans. The previous testimony talked about the number of charters and how Minnesota has the third highest number of charters in the nation, which is really an astounding thing. You know, you think about the fact that Minnesota, with some 5 million people, has more bank charters than much larger states like California or New York. Well, the result of that is really a good thing, because what it means is that small towns often have their own little bank right in that town. It's been there for a long time, which is very important for that local economy. That's a very significant thing when it comes to economic development for that community. We talked a little bit previously about the size of banks. We have a lot of banks, and we have a lot of smaller banks. So of those 400 or so charters in Minnesota, you know, over half of them have assets less than $100 million. So they're fairly small banks, and they might even be as small as 5 to 10 million if they're very small or if they're a de novo bank. Community banks are small business lenders. I mentioned that, but I want to review that and highlight that fact. Like a lot of other small businesses, most of them are sub-S businesses. So we are small businesses, just like the other small ones in Minnesota, owned by second, third, fourth generation, just like a lot of other businesses in Minnesota. And we are a critical source of lending to ag loans, the ag businesses, as well as small businesses. Just to give you a kind of an example of how active they are, according to the Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy, community banks across the country provide 35% of the total dollar amount of loans to small businesses under $1 million, even though we comprise just 12% of industry assets. If you go one step further and look at Minnesota, SBA lending in Minnesota was actually up 14% in federal fiscal year 2010 compared to federal fiscal year 2009. When you look at the details of that SBA lending in FY 2010, 278 lenders combined to make 2,352 SBA loans totaling $513 million to small businesses, and the vast majority of those loans were made by community banks. On the ag lending side, it's kind of the same story. The Rural Finance Authority is a state agency that many of you in greater Minnesota know about. Small banks work with them to make a particular type of loan to an eligible customer. And according to the RFA, 90% of all RFA agreements are with community banks. That's the contract. In order to make an RFA loan, you have to sign a contract with RFA about the terms and the services and the rules. And 90% of those agreements are with community banks. And then when you look at the loan portfolio for RFA, from 2008 to 2010 fiscal years, 64% of all those RFA loans were originated by community banks. The gist of the story I want to say then is that community banks are small businesses, like other small businesses in Minnesota, and our two primary niche markets really are ag and small business lending. I'd like to also kind of highlight the previous discussion regarding regulatory environment. It's always been a challenge for community banks to comply with all of the regulations because they have been mounting periodically over the course of time. And this year now, with the passage of the new Dodd-Frank law and the implementation that'll take over the next several years, there's going to be a new wave upon small banks to comply with those. And generally speaking, you know, all of the banking laws that are made for big banks or small banks, doesn't matter how big you are or how small you are, you all have to comply with those. And so it has become an increasing challenge for small banks, and we will do the best we can, obviously, but it is kind of sapping a lot of energy, time, and investment. With that, that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer those.
Any questions for Mr. Skilbred? Okay, well, thank you very much. Appreciate your overview for the committee. And well, then, members, what we're going to do is we'll go ahead and make that change. So is Senator Carlson here? Why don't you come up and go ahead and present your bill. I think this is our first one, so I'm sure that Senator Scheid and Senator Rest, experienced committee chairs, will correct me if I get the procedure wrong.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Feel free to jump in. But I think first what we're going to do is we'll have, I think Senator Gazelka wants to move the bill.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 125. Actually, this is when it's, once it's done.
Right, you're just going to move the bill.
I move the bill. Sorry, thank you.
Yes, but your motion is that it would be that would
recommended
pass,
adopt,
be recommended to pass, and go to the floor.
That's exactly what I meant.
I don't hear that motion.
That's what I heard.
So, Senator Carlson, if you would present your bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman,
welcome
members
the
of the committee. For the record, I am State Senator John Carlson from Senate District 4, and with me today is Mr. Bruce Mead from Altima Bank. This bill that we have before us today, Senate File 125, is an authorization of a financial institution to locate a facility in Northern Township, which is in Beltrami County. I think the best thing for me to do is to have Mr. Mead talk about the bill and why the need for it. So, Mr. Mead.
Thank you, Senator Carlson, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Mead. I'm the Senior Vice President of Altima Bank, Minnesota. Altima Bank is an independently owned community bank based in Winger, Minnesota, with an office in Fauston and a loan production office currently in Northern Township. In order to expand that loan production office to a full branch with teller facilities and consumer services, we do need to obtain state legislation or a bill authorizing that because we're not located within a municipality. We are located within a township. And that's why we're before you today to make that request.
Okay. I think, I guess I would like to know, and maybe a council could explain this a little bit, about why is legislative approval required for something like this? I know there's a statute that requires it, and the commissioner has some authority. Maybe you could explain to the committee so we're well aware of what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, there are state branching laws, and it's my understanding that as the gentleman, the gentleman indicated, current state law does not allow branching into a township. It has to be a municipality of a certain size, and there's various standards. When that occurs, the commissioner has the authority on his own to go ahead and approve it. But if it's going to be located in a township, special legislation is needed. And we have seen these bills from time to time. I think I recall one about 4 or 5, 6 years ago from Senator Rood. And probably several years before that, there was another one. So from time to time, when a bank wants to branch into a township, you see a special legislation of this nature. Historically, I'm not sure why the law is written that way. I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Murphy has any views on that, but it's a matter of state law now that special legislation is needed for branching into a township.
Okay. All right. And Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out from a geographic standpoint, Northern Township is butts up to the city of Bemidji. That portion of Northern Township is within a 15-year annexation plan, and so it's very close. If you were to go to Mr. Mead's office location where they now currently do loans, you would think that you were still in the city limits of Bemidji, and I think that might help give that a little geographic perspective.
Okay. All right. Senator Bonoff and the rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I heard about the requirement in law, I wondered if it had to do with risk, that there was some concern if a bank is in a very small township, would there be enough business to offset the risk? And so, and I looked up the size of the township, and it is very small, so I was wondering why you'd want to be in this township, but that makes perfect sense. It's next to Bemidji, and that's your market area, and so I understand. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, and Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Carlson, have you approached the Commissioner of Commerce with this situation? Do you have any assurances that the request may be acted on favorably, or your guest?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest,
Senator Carlson.
I have not personally spoke with the commissioner. I guess I would defer that question to Mr. Mead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we have communication from Mr. Murphy at the Department of Commerce that they would that they do not oppose this legislation. They cannot give us approval in advance of an application that will be forthcoming afterwards.
But Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mead, they do not object to it, as far as you know.
No.
Okay. And Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I just wondered, and perhaps Mr. Stang can answer this, is it typical that we just say may establish and maintain, not more than one? In other words, I realize this is within Northern Township, but is that just kind of standard language?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, yes, it is. Every branching bill like this that I've seen puts it that way, so you can't come in and, you know, put in three. You know, a township might abut very different communities or cities, and these are competitive issues involved here as well. So I think that's why the drafting is somewhat careful on that.
Senator Scheid, rather than using one word saying single, lawyers drafted this so they had to use four words.
Charged by the word, right?
All right. Other questions? Okay. Let me ask in the audience, is there anybody that would like to speak in favor or in opposition to the bill? Is there anybody else in the audience? Okay. Seeing none. Any further committee discussion? Any questions? All right. Well, then, hearing none, then the question is on the motion of Senator Gazelka that Senate File 125 be recommended to pass and goes to the floor. All in favor, say aye.
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 And those opposed? The motion prevails. Senate File 125 is recommended to pass. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and congratulations on your first bill.
Yes, your first one. And that worked out well because we want to make sure we keep bankers' hours here and keep on track, right? So it's a... Oh. That's it. Yes. We're going to be talking about another... No, additional financial institutions now with the credit unions. So Mara Humphrey and Mark Cummins coming up to the front, and we'll let you formally introduce yourselves and your organization and how you are similar and different than banks. And as always, members, if you have questions, just feel free to jump in and grab my attention. So welcome to the Senate Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mara Humphrey, I'm Vice President, Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network.
I'm Mark Cummins, President of Minnesota Credit Union Network.
We appreciate you giving us the chance to come in and talk about credit unions. We're always excited to tell people what credit unions are, what we do, who we are. So thank you for the opportunity. If you beg my indulgence, I'm going to start out with just a little bit of basic information about credit unions. One of the most common questions that we tend to get as the trade association is, what's a credit union? How are you different than a bank? Kind of the basic questions. So just wanted to give a quick overview. Credit unions are member-owned, not-for-profit financial cooperatives. The idea is that members can pool their assets together to provide funds for loans and other financial services. What really makes credit unions different is the structure that we're under. Each credit union is owned by its members. Each member has one vote. They vote for the credit union's board of directors. It's operated on a not-for-profit basis, but trying to provide the best services for the members. And therefore, the dividends are paid to members, not stockholders. The members are essentially the stockholders in the credit union. Just to give you a sense, the benefits of a credit union, these are national numbers for credit unions, but the financial benefits that credit unions provide are the higher savings, lower interest, and fewer and lower fees. Those are calculated to be about $7.25 billion nationally. For Minnesota, it's $112 million in direct financial benefits to Minnesota credit union members. Credit unions are also restricted to who can join a credit union. Each credit union has their own set defined field a membership, a common bond that exists between all the credit union members. There's three basic types of bonds that credit unions have. One is occupational. An example of that would be pipe fitters, whether you have a common employer, a trade, or a profession. The next one is an associational membership, which tends to be belonging to an organization, a religious group, or a nationality. For example, we've had a Ukrainian credit union as a common bond. The third type is a community. It's generally a well-defined geographic area that binds together the members in the credit union. Just to give you a little bit of sense of the credit union industry in Minnesota, we have 152 credit unions in Minnesota, 386 credit union branches, 57 federally chartered credit unions, and 95 state chartered credit unions. About two-thirds of the credit unions in the state of Minnesota are state chartered. The assets tend to break out 50-50, though, between state chartered credit unions and federally chartered credit unions. We have 4,300 credit union employees in Minnesota, but 1.5 million credit union members. Credit unions make up about 10% of the market share in Minnesota, and that's been a pretty consistent number over the years. Also, to give you a quick sense, in terms of asset size, I know the bankers brought up the range of assets. Credit unions in Minnesota range from $111,000 to $3.2 billion in assets. It's quite a range. The average asset size, or the median asset size for credit unions, is $19.5 million. In terms of members, I checked this morning, our smallest credit union has 144 members. We have several credit unions who have very part-time employees, up to our largest credit union that has 141,000 members. Just to give you a brief history on credit unions, and I'll kind of jump into the regulatory scheme for credit unions. First, Minnesota Credit Union was chartered in 1925. It was a group of postal employees who joined together to form a credit union. And then the Federal Credit Union Act was enacted in 1934, kind of in the height of the Depression. There was a big movement towards people having a distrust of, you know, the typical financial institutions and kind of bonding together, looking for ways that they could generate access to credit together. And this is really what started the dual chartering system. I know you heard a little bit from the banks about, but the state and federally chartered financial institutions. Our federal regulator is called the National Credit Union Administration. This is an independent federal agency. Its primary mission is to ensure the safety and soundness of credit unions. It's also our regulator on the federal level, and it also administers the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. And the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund, I just want to give you a little bit of background on this. We tend to get questions about how credit unions are insured. This is our equivalent of the FDIC. Same deal as the FDIC. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. Member shares are insured up to $250,000. Never had any money lost by a member of a federally insured credit union. Also, there's never been any tax dollars placed into our share insurance fund. It's always been solely self-funded through credit unions. Moving on to federally versus state chartered. I know you got a little bit of background. Credit unions are similar to banks as in because we have federally chartered credit unions and state chartered credit unions. I know a number of times the Commerce Committee will look and see, you know, when you're looking at law, looking at policy in terms of what you can enact that would impact these types of institutions. On the federal side, federally chartered credit unions are governed by the Federal Credit Union Act, regulated by the National Credit Union Administration. Typically, the laws that would impact federally chartered credit unions in Minnesota relate to consumer laws and business laws. I know there's been a lot of attention given in the Commerce Committees in recent years to foreclosure issues. That's something at the state level that would impact both federally and state chartered credit unions. On the state side, state chartered credit unions are governed by their own statute in Minnesota Statute 52. And really, the state dictates the organization and structure of state chartered credit unions. Also the impact on the business and consumer laws.
As you can see, I get to talk about the really fun stuff with this. And on the examination front, regulatory front, all the Minnesota credit unions have oversight by the National Credit Union Administration as, if you will, the protector of the Share Insurance Fund. The state charters as well then are principally regulated and examined by the Department of Commerce. The examination on both levels is a risk-based focus type examination that meets upon the principles that you see on the screen. One among those, and has been a big point lately within our industry, is the capital and capital adequacy. Legislatively, a well-capitalized credit union is defined as having greater than 7% of their assets in equity. And for credit unions, we don't have access to the marketplace to raise capital. The capital that we have within credit unions is solely generated by the earnings and the retained earnings of the credit union itself. Also, then, there's a variety of asset quality measurements that are in place, but principal among those that are discussed broadly are the delinquency rate of the loan portfolio and then the charge-off rate of those. Those are the principal indicators of how the loan portfolio itself is performing. Earnings typically are also measured on an industry basis. We use the earnings as a percentage of assets, and we have a couple of charts coming up shortly that will address that a little bit. But by doing that, then you can take that smallest of institutions to the largest of institutions and provide a common methodology of comparison between the two. We also file, all of our credit unions file quarterly call reports, as you've heard before. That call report is about a 30-page document. Some of the pages have over 60 data entry points that are within them. But it also provides an excellent off-site examination tool for our regulators to use for oversight, whether they're in the credit union or not. It provides them the access to look at trends quarter by quarter and identify problem spots and either accelerate an examination point or prompt a call to ensure what is going on, or at times to actually make a correction to the filing of the call report itself. Unique to us in credit unions is the supervisory committee. The board, as Ms. Humphrey pointed out, is elected by the members of one member, one vote. The supervisory committee may be elected by the members or more often is appointed by the board of directors, is a voluntary committee to serve on. And their principal responsibility is to ensure that procedures are in place to control the internal management practices, that the financial statements are properly audited and use the general accounting principles. They also serve as a place where complaints from the membership can be registered and dealt with. And then each year at the annual meeting, they make a report to the membership as a whole, independent of the board.
Thank you, Mark. And moving on to the current regulatory environment, I think similar to what you heard from the banks, credit unions are really facing just a ton of regulatory compliance right now. The passage of the Dodd-Frank Regulatory Reform Bill, that's setting up this new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There's going to be 54 provisions that credit unions are going to be working at having to implement in the upcoming year or two stemming out of that bill. And that's from the trade association level. That's really what we're hearing from our members, is just their concerns about the amount of time and resources it's taking to comply with all these new pieces as they try to fit them together. I see Senator Bonhoff has left. One thing I would like to mention is the proposed rule on interchange fees. This is something that is very concerning looking ahead for credit unions. The amendment that was passed actually included an exemption for financial institutions under $10 billion. And that would be all the credit unions in Minnesota. We're really concerned, though, the Federal Reserve has put out a rule that would essentially decrease interchange income by 73%. They based it on the financial institution's costs to provide this above $10 billion. While we were exempted in the legislation, in the marketplace, we are very concerned that we will not be exempted from this rule. And it's going to have a big impact on credit unions, on community banks, on all financial institutions when they're looking at their how do we deliver our services. Unfortunately, it's something that you can't just absorb within the financial institution. It will have to be passed along in some form. Just wanted to give you a brief overview on the current economic climate. I want to reassure you Minnesota credit unions are safe, sound, and secure, but give you a little bit of an overview of what we're seeing right now. Minnesota credit unions have been holding a steady 9.66% capital to asset ratio. As Mark mentioned, you need to be above 7% to be well capitalized. But it's been a tough slog for, I think, all financial institutions lately just because of the economy. Credit unions didn't do any of the horrible bad loans that you hear about, the liar loans. But credit unions are made up of a group of members, consumers, who are, if they're having tough times, the credit union is going to reflect that in terms of them paying back loans. The good news that we've been seeing looking ahead is that delinquency rates have been decreasing over the past year, and we've also been seeing deposits and loans have increased. We've seen a period of kind of a flight to safety when we increased deposits. I think a lot of consumers in Minnesota took a moment and really looked and said, hey, I want to make sure that my money is somewhere safe. And that was somewhat of a wake-up call that they received. And they wanted to look for some place that they felt they could trust that would be a safe place to keep their money. One disconcerting trend along the lines of the realtor's glass half empty, half full theme, we are seeing an increase in bankruptcy rates. Overall, in terms of foreclosures, we've been hearing that they've been steady, leveling out, if not decreasing. But looking ahead, this is a concern for us, and I think it should be a concern for the state of Minnesota that bankruptcy rates keep trending upwards. The Star Tribune did an article 2 days ago. It's not just credit union members, it's all Minnesotans who are seeing an increase in the number of bankruptcies.
One of the real measurements then of the solvency of the institution, for especially in the credit union sphere, is this net worth ratio, and on the graph you can see what the trend is. As much as you might have expected over the last few years, the net worth overall has taken a hit. But when you look at this, the average net worth ratio is 9.6%, which is the blue area here on the line is showing the percent of credit unions in Minnesota that are above the 7% well-capitalized threshold. And although you see a similar trend of decrease, still about just under 91% of the credit unions are above that percentage. All that means is that the credit unions that are below that have to work out a capitalization recovery plan with either the state regulator or the federal regulator to show how and when they plan to get back above that 7% threshold. But overall, for the chart, I think if you look at it, what does it mean? It means that we've gone through one of the most difficult economic periods that any of us have ever experienced in our lifetime, and hope that we don't see again. And yet we have come out with over 90% of our institutions still above that well-capitalized piece. Here on the asset quality are the two ratios that I mentioned before, one being the charge-off ratio, the other being the delinquency ratio. Again, trends I think that you would expect to see given the economic climate that we have. You can see that delinquency has doubled over that period, but delinquency over the has kind of tapered off for the last 3 years. I'll also point out that the numbers you'll see here for 2010 are as of September. The way the call report, all these data is pulled by from the call reports. The call reports are filed with the National Credit Union Administration. They're publicly available. Anybody can go to their website and pull the call report for any credit union that they want. The call reports are filed, the month after the end of the calendar quarter, and then it's about another month before we can actually aggregate the data from all the credit unions to show the specifics. So while we see this here, you know, on the asset quality here, and then also on the capital ratio that we mentioned before, our estimates would be that about 97% of the credit unions will be back above that 7% when we see the final numbers for December. Another thing to keep in mind here when we talk, when you see this increase in the delinquency rate, we're still working with these members to try to solve this issue with them. But the part that you don't see, the invisible part of this graph, is the 98% of the loan portfolio that is performing according to the terms. And, you know, if we played baseball and we had a 98% batting average, you know, we'd be in the Hall of Fame. But we're not. We're in a different business. We're doing very, very well through a very difficult climate and are emerging, I think, on the other side.
Okay. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think we should adjourn without letting members know that as state employees, we're all eligible to join a credit union. It used to be called State Capital Credit Union. It's now called Affinity Plus, and it's located just a block north of the Capitol. And they have an ATM machine in the Capitol, the basement.
A no-fee ATM machine, I believe.
No-fee ATM.
Senator Brown.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Mr. Cummins, Ms. Humphrey, is there a you talked about the call report. Is that similar to, like, a watch list that the credit unions who are – underperforming might be on? Is there any type of watch list like there is for banks?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, there is. The call report data is used in large measure as perhaps the principal tool of the measuring stick of going on to that watch list. Although it's also then the physical examination of the individual institution that will be used to make that final determination. That is done by the state and by the federal regulator, depending on who that body is. Although that you could be on the watch list, but there's no public dissemination of who those particular institutions are.
Okay. If I could ask a follow-up on that, related to that, we had a question about who loses money when a bank fails, and the answer was, well, the investors or the owners. In the case of a credit union, if a credit union should fail, the investors or owners are members. How does that work out? So if a credit union fails, how does that impact the membership?
Mr. Chair, when we talk about our capital as being only the retained earnings, it's the retained earnings of the cooperative, where on the for-profit side, you would know down to the cent the individual share investors' portion of each one of those pieces. So really, those retained earnings are the asset or the equity of the cooperative as a whole. Okay. And so it's really the diminishment of the amount of equity at that point. Hopefully that answers your question, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Dames had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, Ms. Humphrey, can you tell me how many credit unions you have on your watch list at this time?
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, it's not our watch list. That's a charge of the state to do that, and that would have to come from the Department of Commerce. We don't have that data.
Okay. Senator Dames, if you wanted to answer that, I don't know if Mr. Murphy, Deputy Commissioner Murphy, wants to take a stab at that. Just so, because we did have some of those numbers when we talked about the banks, maybe if Mr. Murphy could talk about the credit union watch list. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kevin Murphy, Deputy Commissioner at the Commerce Department. We have currently 29 credit unions out of 95 that are on our watch list.
Thank you.
Any other questions? As long as Deputy Commissioner Murphy's up at the table, any specific regulatory questions about the Department of Commerce's role? Okay. Well, that was a quick question, Mr. Murphy. Thank you very much. And if you want to, Mr. Cummins and Ms. Humphrey, if you want to, any other thoughts on the credit unions, and we'll see if there's any other questions, and then we'll probably be wrapping it up for the day. I do have an announcement as well before we leave.
Mr. Chair, committee members, just want to thank you for the opportunity to come in and present to you. Tomorrow is Credit Union Day at the Capitol, so hopefully you'll be getting visits from your credit union constituents tomorrow. So thank you very much.
You will. Thank you very much. And members, next week looks like we have a lighter week. We have Tuesday, we have the liquor overview. You're not going to want to miss that. We'll be discussing the state regulations and the structure of the three-tier system and how distributors or manufacturers, distributors, and retailers fit into the whole world of liquor regulation. And then on Wednesday, we may not have a meeting. We've got the state of the state going on, and that may cut into our meeting time. So we'll keep you posted on that. And then lastly, if you are interested, there will be an issue coming up in our committee, most likely, dealing with the dentists, the Minnesota Dental Association, having some contracting issues and auditing issues and various things with their insurers or their plans. And what I'm doing is this Friday morning, 7:30 to 9, we're taking a little field trip out to a dentist's office in Bloomington to see exactly what it is there, how this is impacting on them. It's one of the advocates for some changes to the system, so we're going to go hear what they have to say. If anybody wants to join myself and Mr. Cocking, and I don't know if you're going to be going as well, but we're going to go visit a dentist's office and find out exactly what's going on there. So you're welcome to join me. Just let me know, and we'll get you the details on that. All right. Well, nothing else, then this committee is adjourned.